in session. This morning, we have a presentation from Dave Hendricks, Acting Legislative Counsel, on the tort system, so if he'd come forward. I think before we begin, I might just try to clarify with all of us what the schedules will be for the next week. I don't think there will be a meeting of the general committee, the full committee, I mean, on Friday. Is that correct?
That's correct.
That's correct, Mr. Chair?
Yep.
Okay. I think next week, Monday, we'll be starting to process bills. And I do believe that on one day next week, we'll have an overview on the court system and constitutional law.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, a week from Friday, we will have an overview on the court system and touching on the constitutional law, Ronnie.
Okay, so that's the schedule for next week. I hear we have about 40 to 60 bills already in the committee. And I don't know what the breakdown is between civil and criminal law, but we'll be ready to crank it out on Monday morning at 8:30. Mr. Hendricks, please proceed.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Acting Legislative Counsel. Your counsel, Bill Taylor, had asked that I come today and do a representation on tort law. And I apologize in advance to the attorneys on the committee to whom this may sound a little bit of like first year of law school, since Torts 101 was one of the things we all took, I think, the first year of law school as part of getting started as attorneys and figuring out how the law worked. And the first question most of us had was one that probably many of you have, which is what in the heck is a tort? The first thing you have to recognize on that, it has nothing to do with a dessert. Well, there are torts out there, of course, of that type. Tort in this context, it's actually a very old word. It goes back to the Latin. And all it really means when you see tort is a wrong. A tort is a wrong that one person has committed against another. And more significantly, it's a wrong that the law provides a remedy for. As we all know, when we go through life, we have all sorts of bad things happen to us. And frequently, when those things happen, we are told, well, you know, life just isn't fair. And that's true for a lot of those things. Life just isn't fair, and there's not much you can do about it. But there are certain bad things that happen to you, wrongs that are committed against you by other people, for which the law says you should have a remedy for that. You should be able to go into a court and seek damages or some other remedy from the court to basically make you whole for the injuries you suffered. And the whole concept of tort law, it relates to that. It relates to whether or not you have an ability to go in and say, I think that person did something that the law says he has to compensate me for because he did me a wrong. He committed a tort against me. The other big category that's out there of things that people go to court on in civil law is contracts. Contracts versus torts is the big divide. It's the other class we all had to take in first year law school because contracts are different. Contract actions are someone you definitely know. You always enter into a contract with a person, you know, you met. It may not be written, but at least you've met the person before. And when you go to court, you may in fact have some other tort action, but basically what you're asking the court to do is say, I want you to enforce the contract. We had an agreement, enforce the agreement. And that's kind of the big picture difference between tort versus contract. Tort, this person you may never have met before. You know, he was the guy driving the other car that ran into me. There's no contract issue here at all. There's no agreement in any sense. It's simply, this person did me a wrong. I have a right to some sort of recovery on this wrong. Okay, so that's item one on my outline there. What is a tort? The next question is, well, where do you find out whether or not you have this remedy? Where do you go to find these things? And on the outline, I've noted down chapters 30 and 31. But if you look at those chapters, you're not going to find much about what the elements are, for instance, of defamation or what you have to prove in order to do negligence. And the reason for that is that tort law is one of the areas of law where the legislature simply has not come in and substantially codified what is sometimes referred to as the common law, the case law. In order to find out what you need to allege and prove, for instance, in a negligence action, you won't find it in the statutes anywhere. You're going to have to go back and look at the cases. And so this is kind of interesting, because if you look at all the other, so many other areas of the law, the legislature has come in and basically enacted statutes. So if you want to find out how you do these things, you go and read the statutes. It's not the case with tort law. Tort law is largely a matter of looking and reading cases rather than looking at the statutes. Now, we do have some statutes, of course, as over time, you know, different legislatures have come in. Chapter 31 is a new chapter. Up until last session, a lot of this stuff was scattered all over the ORS. And while we were editing the ORS last session, we decided it was time to give these things, get them all in one place, because sometimes we're very hard to find. Some of them were down in the chapter on judgments, et cetera. It didn't make much sense where they'd been placed. So we brought them all together in 31 and kind of laid them out in something like a chronological order of how the tort action worked. But these are primarily about how you do the proceedings. It's not about the basic underlying, what do I have a right to go for? So you have to go back to the cases to say, find out when there's a right to the remedy. And that takes us to item 3. These are not all of the different types of torts that the courts have recognized. It's a kind of representative listing. They're the major ones, I would say, when you take a look at them. And the big difference, the big categories that you see there are broken down: intentional torts, negligence, and then statutorily created torts or causes of actions. The intentional torts are kind of the obvious ones you might think of. I mean, assault and battery. If Bill decided to walk over here and punch me in the nose at this moment, I might in fact have it coming to me, but as a practical matter, the law is going to say, the case law is going to say, well, he may have had it coming, but what he did constituted an assault and battery, and consequently he did me a wrong. He committed a tort by doing that, and the court will recognize that I have a right, if I have to go incur medical bills because of that injury, or if I'm not as pretty afterwards because my nose is crooked, they're going to look at those sort of things and say, okay, if you want to proceed against him, you'll be able to do that. The interesting thing on the intentional torts, these usually don't get a lot of attention in any given session. And I will tell you that as I go through this here, that my emphasis here isn't going to be on the abstract finer points of trying to tell you what you have to prove to succeed in a negligence action. We'd be here a lot longer than what's been allotted to me if we did that. I'm going to try to tie this back into issues that have come up before the legislature in the time I've been here. And I've been doing this area of the law since 1988, so I do have some history going back of what kind of things have come forward. If you look at these, it's unlikely you're going to get a lot of issues coming up before the committee on the intentional torts. Defamation pops up in funny places every now and then. For instance, many licensing boards, for instance, have some sort of provision that says if someone wants to call in to the licensing board and complain about someone, that they're not going to be liable because of what they tell the licensing board. And when you see that, you go, well, why would they be liable? And the reason is because the person, the licensed person, might very well have a defamation action, being able to say, what that person said about me was slander, I'm going to sue them. So it pops up in funny places. In fact, the first series of statutes in 31, the special motion to strike, That's probably better known by its common name. This was addressed to what's called SLAP suits, Strategic Litigation Against Public Participation. And this was one that then Representative Schrader and now Senator Schrader worked on a great deal over a couple of sessions as they worked out how to address the problem of people participating in public, especially local government, and local government proceedings, land use proceedings, things like that, where they came in and would object to perhaps a development in their neighborhood or something, and the perception that sometimes the proponent of some of these measures would file a lawsuit basically just to quell people coming in to talk about things. In other words, strategic litigation, not with any anticipation necessarily they're going to win, but that it would help dampen down the criticism, enable them to move through the process and basically quiet down dissent. So if you look at those things, we came up with a procedural way to try to address those, to get an early determination on when someone claims I'm being sued merely because I came in and exercised my right to do free speech. And so that's really about defamation as well, even though it doesn't say anything as a practical matter. That's the type of actions that were being addressed with that particular motion. But other than that, you don't see a lot of action usually about intentional torts per se. The big one, the really big one, is negligence. Negligence is basically the one that you see with every, you're going to see an allegation of negligence in motor vehicle accidents. You're going to see it when you have a premises liability. Premises liability is land issues. You know, someone comes on my property, falls through the stairs, sues, they say you were negligent, failing to maintain. And then, of course, professional malpractice, the one that's always hot. That's the one we're talking about, medical malpractice, although it can also be any number of any other professionals, including attorneys and any person engaged in professional activities, nurses, et cetera. Negligence, again, is pretty much a matter of case law, and the elements are really pretty simple on negligence when you look at it. I mean, basically, what you have to have is someone with some sort of duty towards you, if you're the person who claims to have been harmed. You have to show that, in fact, they breached that duty. You have to show that that breach was the cause of your damage. And then you have to show that, in fact, you suffered some damages by reason of that breach. So that the elements of that one, if you want to just talk about the elements, are easy. When you start looking at each of those elements, it gets a lot more complicated, especially on things like causation. It can be extremely difficult. In law school, you know, they would give you these long hypotheticals of these sort of Rube Goldberg-type scenarios where somebody did something and by reason of that, something else happened, and something else happened, something else happened, and at the very end, someone gets hurt, and they say, well, how far up the line can they sue? You know, where is the causation cut off? And I'm not going to get into that. You're unlikely to see those issues, because those are things, again, that the courts have struggled with and addressed, and those changing those elements usually are not things that people are asking about. But it's important to recognize that when you're looking at negligence, there are the courts have drawn lines about what kind of, how close the harm and the person has to be to you. What kind of duty do they have to owe? What kind of, how far off up the line they have to be? In the average case, for instance, professional malpractice, these aren't an issue simply because if you're a client, you go down and sit with an attorney and say, I want you to handle my case, and the attorney says, yes, I will, and then they engage in negligence. You know, most of these issues are not. The only real question usually is standard of care. Did you breach your duty? And that's another way of saying, did you breach the duty that this person owned? You look at, well, what's the standard of care? And I've seen that come up in the past sessions over time every now and then in the question of professional malpractice about saying, well, how do you establish what the standard of care is? How big should the community be that you look at? Should it be the entire state, all the doctors in the state, or all the attorneys in the estate that you look at? Should it be a narrower standard? Should there be some standard established by a body somewhere to say what the standard of care should be for practice? Those are those issues that you get into a lot with negligence type claims. Then we have statutorily created causes of action. And these are things that people normally think of as torts, although you could argue that torts technically should just be those things created by the courts, but most of them either look like torts or, in fact, sometimes even substitute for what used to be a case-made claim for relief. Wrongful death is the one that usually is surprising to people because they think certainly that had to have been something you could always sue for, and the fact of the matter is that that is not the case. The survivors of a person who's killed in an automobile accident can only sue because we have a statute that says they can sue. If you had to rely solely on what the law was before the state was formed back in 1859, you'd be out of luck. In fact, one of the first laws passed after we became a state was to create a wrongful death action so that survivors would be able to sue. Product liability, very contentious area, one in which many bills have come through this building over the last 10 or 15 years. Product liability is not a, you can sue for negligence on because you think you've been injured by a, for instance, a vehicle. If you buy a car and you say, wow, you know, whoever put this car together forgot to hook up the brakes and consequently, you know, I had this accident and I was injured. That is one of the theories you can use. Product liability as a statutorily created claim, though, is actually easier to win because normally all you have to show is that it was a defective, a dangerously defective product. Now, clearly, and this usually goes to design, usually is a design issue. They design a car. A few sessions back, we had a bill relating to what were called side saddle gas tanks. And these were in pickups. I had these gas tanks that were placed in such a position that there had been several accidents where people had run into the side of the pickup and they had burst into flames. And the contention was is that these were inherently dangerous products and hence a dangerously a design flaw, and hence you shouldn't even have to show there was any negligence. It was you'd be able to get strict liability underneath the product liability laws. One of the aspects about product liability that's important is the statute of limitations. Normal statute of limitations, I don't know if I even have this on my list. I don't for statute of limitations. Normal statute of limitations for a negligence action in this state is 2 years. 2 years from the time of the act or omission. There are some discovery rules that have been built into that. And by discovery rules, I mean, you know, obviously if there's a pickup with a side saddle and there's a crash and there are flames, you know when it happened. There are tougher issues sometimes with situations where you don't even know until 10 years later that you've been hurt. And the classic example, of course, is the sponge left in the patient, you know, and, gee, I have all these medical difficulties for 10 years, I don't know why, and I finally go back and I see a doctor and I say, oh, when you were operated on 10 years ago, someone forgot to take something out, and you're going to have to go back in, and that was the cause of your problem. So that's the discovery issue of statute of limitations. And in, for instance, with medical malpractice, we have a special statute of limitations on that one. It's a little bit different from that. It's still 2 years if you know, when you know the harm, it's 2 years from when you discover, but the maximum, and this is what's called the statute of ultimate repose, is 5 years. So if you do find out 10 years later about the sponge, you're out of luck. That's the way those work. You have to actually, it has to be within 5 years of when the conduct occurred when you're looking at the ultimate repose one, the one that says beyond this you can go no further. The reasons for statute of limitations are primarily relate to staleness of claims. After a certain point, witnesses disappear. People forget. It gets more difficult to discover the things you need to discover in order both to prosecute or defend. And so everything has some statute of limitations. The debates are always over how long it should be. Products liability, which I was just talking about, is interesting because it is keyed into when the product is put into the stream of commerce. And that's currently it's 8 and up to 10. I'm not sure it's 8 or 10 years after it goes in the stream of commerce. So if you, for instance, are injured by a car that is a 20-year-old car, you're probably not going to have a products liability cause of action. In fact, you're probably not going to have any cause of action back against the manufacturer. So there are limits on these different kind of statutorily created ones, as well as underneath the common law ones. Discrimination is a big category. Most of these you're going to find up in Chapter 659A, which is the chapter on civil rights and discrimination in the ORS. Some of these, in the employment area had common law equivalents. For instance, we always had a common law right if you felt you were wrongfully discharged, but you usually had a fairly narrow number of reasons you could sue based on that. One of the classic cases that was out there was a individual took off time from work to go to serve on a jury, and the employer fired him for doing that. And the courts came in and said, well, even though this was an at-will employee and normally you could fire them for any reason, there was a public policy reason for having people serve on juries, and we feel that employers should not be able to fire people for doing what their civic duty, what the state has asked them to do by serving on a jury. And so they recognize that as one of the grounds for bringing an action by the employee to say, I was wrongfully discharged. And that was a purely common law cause of action. It was one that the courts said, this is one of the reasons why you can sue. Those types of actions are pretty much dwarfed now by the statutory claims you can make for discrimination in employment, housing, accommodations. Those are now the primary source of claims, and it's because they have brought in a whole lot of reasons that probably were not recognized by the common law. If you look at the list of the reasons, it's the obvious ones, things like race, color, nationality, sex, et cetera. But then there are a lot of other things, too, up in 659, where there are also other reasons for bringing a lawsuit under the statute based on discrimination. You see things like there's even things about smoking off work, you know, about not being able to fire someone simply because they smoke, as long as it's, you know, if it's not something where it's on in the workplace or things like that. A whole lot of different types of things. I'm going to move on now from 3 to go on to 4, talk a little bit about limitations on liability, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that later on, too, underneath constitutional issues, because limitations on liability are things that are always an issue in every session here that I've been here, in one form or another. The question always is, you know, how much can we do to limit the liability of some individual, say, this person cannot be sued because of doing this. And as you can see from the list here, we've got interesting, this is just a small portion, of course. Again, there are literally probably, there are dozens if not hundreds of statutes that address limitations of liability of some sort or another. These are just kind of representative of the ones that are have been passed over time, give you some idea. Good Samaritans is the one that most people know about. If a doctor is driving along the road, there's an accident, doctor jumps out of the car, goes to help. There's going to be the Good Samaritan statute sets a slightly different standard of care for that person, saying we recognize that the doctor here is not in ideal conditions, you know, on the side of a road trying to help this person. We're not going to allow that person to sue on the normal standards that you would apply if you were in a hospital providing the same care, we're going to say there's going to have to be something equivalent to gross negligence if there's going to be, if we're going to allow someone to sue. You're going to have to do something totally incompetent. The idea being that you want to encourage people to help. And the bigger question that comes along from time to time is, well, shouldn't that be true for all volunteers? And we see those issues come up. And the federal government actually passed a law relating to volunteer liability, limitation on the liability of volunteers at one point. It does provide some protection, but there are frequently questions about, well, shouldn't we give immunity to all volunteers? And that may come up against some of the questions on constitutional issues, and we'll talk about those in a little bit. The recreational use of land is interesting because we just had a case on that last month. We have had a law for a long time that said if you go onto someone's property for recreational purposes, and we're talking here fishing, hunting, hiking, all sorts of different things, and if you're not paying a fee, I think there's some, can't remember if it's any fee, I think it's no fee, as long as you're not paying any fee whatsoever, that you will not be able to sue the landowner simply because of the things that happen because of the condition of the land. Now, that changes common law to some degree because under the common law, you know, these people may have had some claim. This limits it and says, no, you won't be able to sue. You have complete immunity. The case that came up last month was interesting because it dealt with a city park. And there was a swing set, and there was an allegation that a child had been hurt by reason of use of the swing set. The plaintiff wanted to argue that this limitation did not apply, arguing that really that law wasn't intended to apply to things like city parks, but the Court of Appeals, based on the language of the statute, said, no, it says any public or private land. This looks like a recreational activity to us, and so they denied recovery and said that the city was immune by reason of this statute. So you can see here the types of things, farming, forest practices, equine activities, ski operators, things like that, where we have over time had limitations on liability come in. And we'll talk again about constitutional issues in a little bit. Remedies. Remedies is where we have had a lot of activity in the legislature over the last few years, starting especially with that first bullet point there, economic and non-economic damages. As we all know, we just had an election in which there was a measure which would have put a cap of $500,000, and I think it was limited to medical malpractice. I forget it. I read it, but it's been a while since I looked at it. The reason that measure was on the ballot, and this was the second time that a similar measure has been on the ballot, the first one was in 2000, was because of a case called Lakin versus Senko Products, and that came down at the very end of the session in 1999. And it's the first case on that list of cases on that handout that I gave you, and Lakin's kind of a key case because it's the first one where the court used the analysis they used to look at liability limitations, caps on damages, things like that. And in 1987 was had a huge amount of activity relating to torts and to liability insurance, since those things tend to go hand in hand. 1987, there was a huge bill that passed out. I believe it still holds the record in our office for the most number of proposed amendments at 125 proposed amendments to that bill. I think every person in the office at that time at one point or another wrote at least one amendment to that bill. It was highly contentious. When it came out, it had a lot of the statutes that it enacted several of the statutes that now appear in Chapter 31, including the provision that now appears at 31.710, which put a limit on non-economic damages, a $500,000 cap on non-economic damages. I should tell you that non-economic damages, when you look at the definition, we're primarily talking about pain and suffering. That's the primary non-economic damage. Lost earning capacity and things like that are basically treated as being economic rather than non-economic. So you're primarily talking about about pain and suffering from wars. So we had that law in 1987, and it was in effect until 1999 when the Supreme Court looked at that statute and said that that statute violated Article 1, Section 17 of the Oregon Constitution, which is the right to a jury trial. I'm going to talk about this in a little bit, so I'm not going to dig into that too much. The important thing here is to note that there's a broad range of damages that are available. One of the issues that have come up over time is the ability to try to limit those damages or cap those damages to help with the problems that arise out of liability insurance, and I'll talk about that a little bit further later, but for now, move on to punitive damages. Punitive damage is another thing that has come up. The second session that since I've been here where there was a lot of work on torts generally was 1995. And at that time, there was a lot of time looking at punitive damages. Punitive damages, by definition, are damages that the jury or the trier of fact, the court, awards to basically punish the wrongdoer. And in intentional torts, that's pretty obvious why you would want to do that. It's to deter bad behavior. If Bill decided to punch me, the court might say, well, not only did he punch you, but he had absolutely no reason to do it whatsoever. And so we're going to say, we don't want to see this behavior going on in society, even though Dave only had, a $20, I don't think you can have a $20 doctor. Let's say, well, I'm covered by insurance. I have no loss. So I say, even though, his medicals were not significant, et cetera, we're still going to hit Mr. Taylor with a big punitive damage award to make sure he doesn't do that again and to let the rest of society know that we don't tolerate that type of behavior. So intentional torts, punitive damages, and that's the most common place where you see punitive damages are in those scenarios. Negligence, which we've talked about, negligence is slightly different because normally if you're driving down the road and you get distracted and you don't see the stop sign and you run through the stop sign and you hit somebody, normally that's what I think most courts look at and say ordinary negligence. Nothing's, you weren't paying attention. It's nothing that arises to the level where we're saying, well, we're going to punish that because you weren't paying attention. They don't do that usually on those types of just ordinary negligence. Different scenario. You're driving down the road and you're drunk. And you blow through a red light because you're drunk and you hit somebody. Court looks at that and says, now here's some behavior we really need to deter. We're going to look at this, and what they usually refer to this is as gross negligence, not just mere negligence. This is real negligence. We're going to say that in those types of cases, we will award punitive damages, and that's one of the clear cases in negligence actions where you can say, okay, punitive damages may be awarded. Now, that doesn't mean you can't have it, for instance, in a medical or an attorney malpractice case. You can. You have to show, in fact, that it was not just ordinary inadvertence. It was something beyond normal. It's something that the average practitioner would look at and say that is beyond the pale of what the standard of care would require. So you can have them in those type of cases as well. And when you do have them, they can be significant amounts. The thing that happened in 1995 with punitive damages was primarily a pleading requirement. There was a feeling that people automatically pled punitive damages, that they would throw it into every claim, and especially with respect to professionals, the thought was there should not be, there's a certain, it casts a certain light on the professional, even if it's just a complaint and everybody knows it's just an allegation. The fact that you've been accused of it being grossly negligent carried a certain issue with it. So the reaction to that was to do a pleading change, basically saying when you file your complaint now, you can't ask for punitive damages. You have to amend it, and you have to make certain showings later on, certain minimal showing to show that, in fact, you've got some good grounds for asking for punitive damages before you just throw it in your complaint right off the bat. So basically, you have to come back in and ask at a later point to be allowed to ask for punitive damages. You can't just file a complaint and say, I want punitive damages. The other important thing to note about punitive damages is that right now only 40% of punitive damages go to the plaintiff, the person suing. 60% of them go to crime victims assistance. I forget the exact name of the program that DOJ runs. DOJ actually, Department of Justice, collects those amounts for crime victims. So if there is an award of punitive damages, 60% of that actually goes in, do not go to the plaintiff, it goes to other places. And I'll talk a little bit about that as well in the constitutional law, because there was some questions about whether if we could do that. We can. I'll go ahead and talk about it now, just since we're talking about it. The question on that was, is, well, look, if you can't say we can cap non-economic damages at $500,000, how can you say that 60% of the punitive damages you get go to the victim's assistance program? Isn't that also problematic underneath the right to jury trial, the ability to get to the jury? And what the court finally came down and said when they were faced directly with that issue is they said punitive damages are different. Punitive damages, unlike non-economic damages and economic damages, were not in place to make the person whole who was injured, who was wronged. They were never there for that purpose. They were there to punish the wrong. They were there to punish Mr. Taylor for going out and punching people in the nose. And because of that, those rules relating to what the Constitution requires just don't apply to punitive damages. If the legislature wanted to abolish punitive damages, they could, simply because they were there for a purpose other than to make the person whole, so you don't have the same issues that you've got with non-economic damages. You'll note at the very bottom of that first page I mention health practitioners. The reason I mention that is, as part of the 1987 bill, the one I've already mentioned, there was a law passed that prohibited the award of punitive damages against health practitioners. In fact, we had a law that for health practitioners that said, you know, you could not award punitive damages. And so there was some question after Lakin came down whether that would hold up. The interesting thing about that is that when they enacted that in 1987, they put in a little exception that said that this limitation on the award, let's see if I can find it, was acting without malice. That was going to be the limitation. So, well, you can get punitive damages if they're acting with malice. Well, what's happened with that is that the Court of Appeals came along and said that they looked at that without malice, and they thought that was the same standard as gross negligence under the common law, and they basically held that that statute enacted in 1987 had no effect. So that statute's sitting there, but the courts have basically said that because they've said that you have to show that they're acting with malice, that that was the equivalent of saying they were grossly negligent, and they've basically have rendered that statute pretty much moot as a way to try to avoid punitive damages for health practitioners. That case came down about a year ago, if I'm not mistaken. Okay, attorney fees. What you need to know about attorney's fees in tort cases is that generally there aren't any. I say that at least at the beginning of the case. I say that because Oregon follows what's called the American rule on attorney's fees. There's an American rule and an English rule. English rule on attorney's fees, in England, if you sue somebody, in any case where somebody gets sued, the prevailing party gets an award of attorney's fees. That's the rule they follow. And so the plaintiff going into the case has to recognize, if I sue, I might get stuck paying the defendant's attorney's fees if I lose. I believe only one state does that, at least the last time I looked at it, Alaska had a similar provision. Here in Oregon, we follow the general rule, the American rule, which is that attorney's fees are only available if there's a contract that provides for them or there's a statute that specifically provides for them. There is no statute that says that if you sue somebody for a tort, that you have a claim for attorney, that the prevailing party will be awarded attorney's fees. There is one for small claims. I believe those are $5,000, $7,500. That one there is in existence for a very specific reason, and that was the fear that in small claims, the defendant would simply say, well, good luck on getting an attorney to handle your $5,000 claim. And even if you do, the attorney's fees will eat up anything you get anyway. So there is a provision allowing for an award of attorney's fees in these small claims. It has a provision that says that the plaintiff has to give the defendant notice and give him an opportunity to settle the thing before the complaint is filed. But if they do that, they go to trial, they prevail, they can get an award of attorney's fees. But the general rule is, no, attorney's fees are not available. Contingent fee agreements is another issue. Contingent fee agreements is an agreement between a person who thinks they've got a case and the attorney that says the attorney will get paid from the recovery. And it's usually done on a percentage basis. I know how they worked back when I was in practice. That was many years ago, but I know what they typically provided for back then. They were usually on a scale depending on how far the case progressed before you got a settlement or a recovery. Frequently X percent if you settle it before you filed the complaint, X percent if you settled it before you went to trial, X percent if you recovered after trial. And I don't know what the percentages are. I suspect that I don't know if there's a common percentage out there anymore. I know in the old days they could run as high as 50% of the recovery. We've seen bills in the past relating to those arrangements as well about what could be in contingent fee agreements. I do have a thing on statute of limitations. I already kind of said what I was going to say on that. Most of those are in Chapter 12. We frequently get calls in our office saying, can you tell us what the statute of limitations is? And they're usually from individuals. Maybe they've had a car accident or something. That's the one question that my policy has been to never answer. You know, even if they say, well, can't you just tell me what it is for negligence, I'll say, you know, you need to talk to an attorney. And the reason is that the statute of limitations is so fact contingent that if you told them that, and if you said, well, normal statute of limitations is 2 years, and they say, oh, I got 2 years, well, then what happens is you find out that the person who ran into him was a state employee. You know, you don't know that because they didn't tell you that. And what happens is they don't realize that under the Torts Claim Act, which we're going to talk about down here, if you're going to be suing a public employee, you have to give a 180-day notice or you're out of luck. So, you know, and it's just one of those areas where you do not want to really give, you know, strong answers because you're probably going to get in trouble. As I said, the normal one's 2 years. Defamation, 1 year. There's variations on some of these. Medical malpractice has slightly different ones. They kind of run all over the place. I mentioned there the Dram Shop Act. That's the Dram Shop Act. The Dram Shop Act is actually the law that says that you can sue either a social host or a tavern owner who's who serves an intoxicated person. They go out, they run into somebody because they're intoxicated. You have a claim back against the tavern owner or the social host. It can be a social host as well. It can just be someone in your home if you continue to serve them and they go out and cause an accident. I mention that because we actually inserted a similar 180-day notice requirement for those claims as well. So, again, you know, it's statute of limitations is a very tricky area, very tricky, very hard one to go through all the fact situations. Okay, comparative negligence. This has been one that's been, was part of the 87 issues, part of the 95 issues. What in the heck's comparative negligence? First thing you have to know about comparative negligence is when you're talking comparative negligence, you're talking more than one defendant. The plaintiff is suing more than one person for their injuries. And you may think, well, how often does that happen? It happens a lot because plaintiffs by nature will sue anybody they think was involved or contributed in some way to the injury suffered by the individual. In the medical malpractice area, usually you may have a doctor, you may have a nurse, you may have a hospital, you may have any number of defendants that are brought in and with a claim and saying, we think you in some way contributed to this incident. In an automobile accident, there may be a three-car pileup, and you say, well, I think both of these folks were involved in it, you know, causing my injuries, so I'm going to sue them. So you end up with these scenarios where there are multiple defendants. And that's where you get into the questions relating to, okay, how do you split up the liability? How do you split up the damages in the event the plaintiff recovers? If the plaintiff is at fault, and that's not uncommon in an automobile accident, a debate about did the person who's suing, were they also to some degree at fault? Juries look at that as well. They look and say, well, did the plaintiff do something wrong here that they should not recover for because it was partially their fault? And Oregon has a rule that says that as long as the plaintiff is not more than 50% at fault, they can recover. So if the jury finds the plaintiff to be 51% at fault, plaintiff, you're out of luck. Defendant, you're free. If the plaintiff, for instance, is 25% at fault, they can recover for the 75% of liability that's left, but they can't recover for that portion that's attributable to their own fault. I have a note here, pure comparative negligence. The issue underneath the common law always was something, it was an issue called joint and several liability. Under the old law, back in 1859, if you sued more than one defendant and the jury found, if the jury found that the plaintiff was, that one of them was only 5%, 20%, 30%, whatever, the person, even though they're only 5% at fault, were liable for the full amount. They were liable for everything, even though they were only even found to be only 5%. So what the changes in the statute have done have basically kind of eliminated that concept and said, look, everybody is going to be liable only for that portion that they is attributable to them. But in other words, if you're only 5%, you're only liable 5%, you're only 5% of the damages. The one change, the one limitation we have on that is this reallocation provision, 31610. And that came in 1995. And basically what that says is if you have someone, let's say someone is 30% at fault and somebody else is 70%. If that person, say the person with 30%, the plaintiff has tried for a year to try to collect against this person and has been unable to collect, they can go back to court and say, Your Honor, I want you to reallocate that portion to the person who's found 70% at fault because I can't collect against this person. So the person, even though they were 70% at fault, will end up with the full burden of paying this if, in fact, the plaintiff can't collect against the one who's found with the lesser amount. I'm going to talk a little bit about torts by Mac Confucius, and I'm going to shut up. It's been a long...
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
I think I got sued 5 times as a county commissioner on racketeering charges. sounds absolutely horrible, you know, except your judges are named, your county commissioners, your police authorities, and then there's collusion and all that kind of thing. When you were talking about the multiple percentage of responsibility, is that indicated in the original lawsuit, or is that something that has to be proven?
Chair Ackerman, Representative Garrard, what happens is that all of these names go to the jury or the trier of fact, and they are asked to assign percentages of liability to each person. So the jury actually decides that.
Okay. Thank you.
I should ask if anybody else had any questions. I've been kind of plowing along here. No. Let me get to the end here since it's...
I was never found guilty.
Yeah, the RICO Act, the racketeering and racketeering, influence, and corrupt organizations act. Horrible acronym, horrible name. Drafted originally for the feds by a law professor back east, who I heard a radio interview on for a few years ago, and confirmed my awful suspicion that he made up the name of the act in order to get the acronym, in order to get to RICO in the movie where Edward G. Robinson played a gangster. I'm thinking it was Little Caesar, where he played a gangster called RICO, and the final line was it was Edward G. Robinson dying on the sidewalk saying, "Is this the end of RICO?" And I think that's awful. Because now we are foisted with racketeering, influence, and corrupt organizations act. All anyway. Tort Claims Act, real quickly. Tort Claims Act governs how you sue a public body. And I'll tell you real briefly, back underneath the old law, you couldn't sue a public body. You couldn't sue the state. It was called sovereign immunity. And the reason you couldn't sue it, the theory was, is that the king could do no wrong. That, in essence, that the state, acting in lieu of the king, essentially could determine whether or not its activities were harmful to someone or not, and if they decided to do it, that no one had a right to sue because of what the state did. Well, that didn't last very long. That was about the second act that was passed after the state was formed, was to allow some suit against public bodies. But they didn't give up everything. The state did not give up everything. It said, well, you can sue public bodies, but we're going to put caps on how much you can recover. We're going to say you can sue us, but you can only recover up to $100,000 for your claim based on personal injury, for instance. And so the Torts Claim Act is interesting because it basically says it isn't really a true cap on damages when you look at it. It isn't saying you could used to be able to sue us for anything. We're going to say, no, you can only sue us for this. It actually says you didn't used to be able to sue us for anything. We'll let you sue us for up to certain amounts if you have a tort claim against a public body. The other interesting thing on it is that the Torts Claim Act applies to public bodies and also, more significantly, to its employees, officers, and agents. If you sue a public employee by reason of something they did in the course of their work, what the Torts Claim Act says is that it literally says you can't sue them. You can only sue their employer. You can only sue the public body. And you can make, if you're the public employee, you get sued, you can, the state can make a motion to say, this person you can't sue, you can only sue us, take them out of the case. And that's what happens in those cases, that your only claim is back against the public body. The duty to indemnify is important because that's the other piece of the puzzle. It says that if I'm an employee and I get sued, and it's because of what I did in my job as a public employee, the state or somebody has an obligation basically to take on the case, to try the case, and to pay any damages that are awarded. So that is important, of course, because in essence that is the insurance policy for public employees. The state is self-insured for liability claims. They're insured through risk management in the Department of Administrative Services. They charge each state agency. Our office, for instance, gets a bill from DAS that says you have to pay this premium for your liability insurance. Our premium is extremely low because our experience of claims has been extremely low. Other agencies have bills that are fairly high because they have the sort of, for instance, Department of Transportation and some of those where they have a lot of people on the roads in cars, you're going to have more claims because of auto accidents and things like that, and they can have fairly significant. And it's risk management is just run just like an insurance company. It's based on your experience and what kind of claims you've had, and they provide the insurance for state employees. Local governments have their own ways of providing for it. I believe some of them are self-insured, some of the bigger ones. Others simply can't buy a policy of insurance to provide the coverage. I just want to say a few things about constitutional issues because they come up whenever we talk about liabilities thing. I've already talked about Lakin and the cap on damages, the $500,000 cap on damages. I think that when you go through these cases and look at them, what I think the law is still pretty murky about where we're at on liability limitations. Each of these cases addressed a specific statute or provision. Lakin looked at that one statute, said there'll be a cap of $500,000. Some of these others, like Jensen v. Whitlow, the last one actually looked at the Torts Claim Act and said, how can you say you can't sue public employees? How come you can't sue them? Why can you only sue the public body? What the court said in saying, no, the Torts Claim Act is okay, was they said, well, because the legislature provided an alternative, you can sue the public body. And they said, so that's okay. But there are certain underlying questions that come out of these cases that have yet to be resolved. I look at statutes that provide general exemptions from liability that just says you can't sue this person. And my next question that I usually follow up with, well, if we can't put a cap on the damages that can be awarded to a person who's injured, can we pass a law that says you can't sue them at all in the first instance? And we haven't had that case really yet in the Supreme Court, except in cases similar to like Jensen v. Whitlow, where they've kind of suggested that, well, it's okay as long as you provide an alternative remedy. In a lot of these statutes where we just say you can't sue them, it's not clear where the alternative remedy is. I haven't seen that case, and as I mentioned, we still have cases coming down similar to the one on limitation, liability limitations on recreational use of property, where I don't see anybody raising those issues on those types of statutes. I don't know if the court will find a way to distinguish between those, but I think those questions are out there, and until we get those cases, it's going to be hard for us in our office, for instance. I think we're going to be giving at least some warnings on bills coming through saying, for instance, if someone comes in with something that says we want to eliminate all liability for volunteers, I think there's still a question out there under this lake and in some of these cases about whether the courts eventually might not look at that and say, we don't think you can do that. So that's just kind of a general warning on that issue. They're not there yet. They're not there yet, and maybe they never get there, but I think it's something we would raise for folks as they came in. And I think you've probably heard enough from me for the morning.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Hendricks, could you describe how your office deals with those constitutional issues you're just alluding to? It sounds like you'll raise the issue. Will you, regardless of what the request is, always respond to a request for drafting, even if there's a constitutional flaw, even an obvious constitutional flaw, and that would just with a sort of an oral caveat? Or is there ever a point where you say, no, it's a waste of everybody's time and energy?
Representative Chair Ackerman, Representative McPherson, we never tell someone we can't draft something. I mean, that's the member's prerogative. I always will be. We will, of course, raise constitutional issues. Sometimes we will call beforehand and see, and if the member says, well, still want to do it, we'll write a cover letter to go with it to the member explaining concerns. There are some cases, many cases are not so clear, of constitutional, unconstitutional. As I mentioned, this is one of them. There are issues. It's not something where we can say, the courts will certainly strike this thing down. There are some like that. But I don't think there'll be a surprise when many of the members see these bills as they're printed that many of those will probably jump out anyway and say, can we do that? But there are other ones where it gets hazy, and then we do try to write the letter to the member to alert them to the concern.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
President Grog.
Dave, earlier some legislators were warned about contacting local judges on behalf of constituents, that a legislator does not have the license to practice law just because he's a legislator. Could you define that a little bit more from the standpoint of where's that line drawn? If you have a constituent who maybe has a couple DUIs and you've known that individual and they want you to write a letter to the judge, where's that line?
Chair Ackerman, Representative Garrard. There are two issues there, it seems to me. One is if the trial, you know, if it's an ongoing matter, if it hasn't been adjudicated yet, you know, courts get letters from all sorts of people all the time on various cases, and what they do, if they're doing their job right, is they ignore them. And it wouldn't make a difference if it's from a legislator or from anyone else, unless the legislator has some evidence that's relevant that should be coming in through the process. The court's going to, if they get a letter, you know, before adjudication, they're going to go saying, gee, I don't think this person did this. He's a nice person. They're probably going to ignore that just because, you know, they're there to adjudicate and they're supposed to do it based on the evidence that's presented in the proceeding, not on letters they get, no matter who they're from. The other issue is when you get to sentencing, and then, of course, there may be issues where, in fact, a legislator could, in fact, be of some, if, in fact, it was a conviction and they wanted to have, say, a letter of reference or something for purposes of the subsequent proceedings, that's fine. The real problem with sending letters to the courts, it seems to me, is that, A, it doesn't, it should not have any effect on the proceeding anyway, and I think all of the judges would probably follow that line. And the other, there is that that tougher question of the perception of legislative branch and, you know, intermingling with the judicial function in the judicial branch. The line, you know, definitely as far as did this person do it, that, you know, input there should probably be limited unless you have some evidence about the case at hand before you get to the decision. I doubt if it's going to avail any legislator to send along.
Follow, Mr.
Chair? Sure, go ahead.
In that the legislature sets the salaries of the judicial system, is there a connection with an action that we may do plus that?
Chair Ackerman, Representative Garrard, the legislature does set the compensation. There are actually protections for the judge's compensation in the Constitution, and what those provisions indicate is that you can't reduce it during their term, and they have 6-year terms. And so, you know, whenever they do a change in compensation, et cetera, you know, you could only lower the compensation of a judge at the end of the term of each judge, each sitting judge. So that was intentionally built into the Constitution specifically to protect judges from the results of unpopular decisions, to be honest, if you go back and look at the Constitutional Convention.
I'm off the track of what we were doing before, but I appreciate your answer, David. It's just...
Okay, further questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Counsel.
If no one else has a question, I do. Mr. Hendricks, under Roman numeral 3, we have statutorily created causes of action. Is it not possible to indirectly create a statutorily created cause of action? I'm thinking of the case out of Astoria where the lady was arrested for being under the influence, was brought into the police station. There was a statutory duty to keep her there until she was sober. They released her. She walked out into the street, got hit by a car, and her estate sued the Astoria Police Department, and I think the courts talked about because it was a duty to keep her there, there was a breach of that duty, there was third-party liability.
Chair Ackerman, Counsel Taylor, yes. There have been a handful of cases that come out where the courts have inferred that the Legislative Assembly intended to create a cause of action, even though the statute did not specifically so provide. And I'm thinking that those may be limited scenarios. They are cases where there normally would not have been a cause of action. There would not have been a cause of action, but because the legislature passed a law that told a public official, you shall do this. The other example is that has come up is there's a law that says that if the police are called to a domestic disturbance, mm-hmm. and they get there and they find out that there's a restraining order against the person who is creating the disturbance, in other words, and they're in violation of that order, that the police shall arrest them on the spot. No discretion. And the case that came up was, didn't arrest them, injury occurred, lawsuit. And the question, normally that with discretionary, there would be some discretion there on the officer to make that decision, not necessarily result in a cause of action. And the courts on a couple of those cases have indicated that they will find a basically implied intent from the legislature. I am hoping they're kind of backing away from that because I have real difficulties with that, and I've expressed it before in different forums. It seems to me the legislature knows how to create a civil cause of action. They do it a lot. I draft them a lot. If the legislature wants to create one, they'll create one. It gives me difficulty when the court comes along and implies the intent to create that remedy based on, it's sometimes very unclear. I mean, usually the law does not give a clear indication. I don't find the legislative intent in some of those cases that there be a cause of action. So, yes, those cases are out there.
Thank you.
I think that arises primarily from a situation when we not necessarily create a new claim or new cause of action, but we impose a mandatory duty upon someone to act in such a fashion. They fail to act, defending the injured party that can have a claim, even though it may have not intended to create a claim. I think that was analogous in the two examples that were given by counsel.
Yeah. Chair Ekman, that's correct. The thing to distinguish that from is, I have it down here as negligence per se, and I didn't talk about it. That's a slightly different category of cases. For instance, we passed a law that said that school zones, for instance, 20 miles an hour. If someone is driving 40 miles an hour through a school zone, clearly marked, and hits a child, even assuming for the we're assuming for a moment there is no, they're just going to sue based on negligence. The fact that the legislature passed a law saying we want you to go 20 miles an hour in a school zone, and it's very clear the reason we're doing that is to protect kids from getting hit by cars in school zones, that when you sue on negligence, you can go in and you do a claim what's called negligence per se. You can say, look, the state has established what a safe driving speed is, 20 miles an hour. You were doing 40. That's it. We win on the negligence claim as far as whether or not you're negligent, because we can say even that in this case you, in fact, were beyond what the legislature has established as being the safe driving speed in that zone. That's a little bit different, but that comes up quite a bit, and it's frequently in automobile cases one of those issues that come up because there are so many rules governing the use of the road, and if you break them, it gives you a pretty clear shot if you're the plaintiff at being able to establish that. Yeah, you were negligent because the legislature decided here's what the safe conduct is.
Thank you. Further questions for the committee? Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hendricks, and since you used the example of the 20-mile-per-hour speed zone law, and the state established the 20-mile-per-hour in order to protect children, and the conflict, as I understood, that came forward was the interpretation of when children present. That was being interpreted by the courts as any time that a children could be reasonably expected to be in the area, even though they were not in the sight of a driver. Can you help me with that?
Chair Ackerman, Representative Flores, I don't pretend to be an expert on this particular area. I certainly, just as a driver, have always wondered about when children are present because, you know, you look at it and it raises many questions about how present do they have to be. I mean, how close, where exactly, et cetera. And I believe that many of the changes that were made in the statutes last session were trying to address that. Now, I know we've had a lot of questions about how successful that effort was, and I would be surprised if we don't have several proposals to revisit the way they ended up handling the school zones. The court's interpretation, I think the court's interpretation, again, when the statute, if indeed when you have something like that, when children are present, it's going to leave quite a bit of room for the courts to decide what it was that the legislature intended. And you're going to have a presentation at some point from the couple of judges from the Court of Appeals about the way the Court of Appeals figures out what the legislature intended when they passed the law. I think that one there may be very helpful for you if you get a chance to watch, because they're going to talk about how they determine the legislature's intent, and they're going to talk about these very issues, about things like this where, well, what were they trying to get at? And they do have a very complicated and specific regimen they go to arrive at this. I think that that would be a good place for you to listen to kind of get an answer about how to communicate to the judges what it is the legislature intends to do.
Thank you.
Further questions from to counsel? Okay, any further business to come before the committee? We stand and adjourn.